Hi, everyone. Welcome to Live Greatly. I am your host, Crystal Bauer, and I'm so very excited to be here today sharing some wonderful information with all of you. And I'm very lucky to have an amazing guest today, Caitlin Hildebrand, who is going to be releasing her new book on LESS very soon. And Caitlin's a fellow with me at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine through the University of Arizona. She is a nurse practitioner, a nurse manager at an integrative health center, VA in California. She's also a yoga instructor and a mindfulness teacher. So I'm really excited to talk with her today. And just as a reminder, everything discussed here is not medical advice. This is not meant to diagnose, treat, or prevent any illnesses, and discuss all health-related matters with your healthcare professional. So welcome, Caitlin. And I'm really excited that you're here. And I just thought we could start out by maybe you giving us a little bit of a background about yourself.
Thank you. Hi, Crystal. It's delightful to be on the show today. And I'm so happy to be here to talk with you all about the role of mindfulness journaling in my new book, Unless. My background, as you asked, I've been a nurse practitioner in primary care for about a decade. And I have a great passion for integrative medicine, combining complementary and alternative treatments with conventional medicine. And my background that's the most relevant to this book is my own personal background with struggling with food and body image, as well as my professional work in primary care and in mental health, as well as mindfulness.
Wonderful. And, you know, the name of your book is Unless, and I was just hoping that you could share with us, you know, how you picked that title and, you know, why you decided to write the book now.
Yeah. So the full title is Unless, Mindful Journaling for Body Positivity, Wellness, and Unconditional Self-Love. And the reason that I chose this word, Unless, is that the book is really about giving yourself more. So much about wellness in our society can be about deprivation and restriction, and that really does not promote body positivity or self-love. So this is really about learning to give yourself more of all of those things, showing yourself more respect and tenderness, and more of what you do need, which is movement and healthy food and healthy eating behaviors. I'm writing about this now, that the book is coming out now, but really I've been writing about this for over a decade. It started with a blog, which I used to help overcome my own fraught relationship with food and body image. And then that evolved into the book. And as I studied more and more in the world of mindfulness and motivational interviewing about how to help people create change, that is how I developed the book on using mindful journaling to change your relationship with how you think about your body and your wellness.
Thank you for sharing your book with me. I absolutely loved it. And you talked in the book about, you know, mindful eating, and you know, you're mentioning mindfulness, and for those of you out there who don't really know about mindfulness, you know, my understanding is that it's trying to be present in the current moment, you know, so in the here and now. And you also in the book talked about being aware of the past and aware of the future. So I'm just curious, like, how you can kind of incorporate that. Like, how can you be mindful while you're eating, but also be aware of where you've been and where you want to go?
Such a good point. So many times mindful eating is defined as the practice of paying attention to the sensations of the eating practice. And that is very beneficial, as you say, but many of us are already very in the moment when we eat. And we eat for the moment. We eat whatever is the most delicious right in front of us right now. And we also, though, in order to have a healthy relationship with food and body image, need to think about our triggers. In other words, where we've come from, the preconceived notions we have about how we should eat and how we should look, what cultural family background brings that those ideas into our consciousness, as well as think about where do we really want to be? How can we be truly more radiant, more vibrant in the future? And how does our eating impact both of those? So yes, it is mindful eating, but from a much more holistic viewpoint.
Mm-hmm. I love that. It's really well said. You talked about in the book, discovering your why. And You talked about, you know, how if you come up with the wrong why, if you're not really getting to, I guess, the root of your why, like, for example, you said, if you're trying to eat well to fit into a bridesmaid dress for an upcoming wedding, you know, that probably isn't going to be as long standing for your success versus if your desire to be healthy and to eat well is to, you know, for example, start a family or to reduce your risk of cancer, you know, that is probably going to be more meaningful for you. So I guess my question is, how would you suggest that people can discover their why? You know, we're so busy as a society, we're go, go, go. I think it's hard for a lot of people to take time to reflect. So just what suggestions do you have to help people really connect with their why?
Well, that is where journaling comes in. Journaling is a fabulous practice, and it's been shown in research to be extremely effective at helping people change behavior. You can always carry a small journal with you, and it's a great tool to help you verbalize your thoughts in a way that helps you get out of a default mindset, that same, you know, narrative, the same record that might always be playing around in the background. When you have to actually write it out, you become more conscious of the biases you may even hold towards yourself and others. And so using mindful journaling exercises, which this book is full of, will really help you prompt how to learn your why. What is where you need to go? And how can you get there in a way that's truly holistically beneficial to not only your body, but also your mind and your spirit?
I love that. That's wonderful. You know, you were really open in the book, which I give you a lot of credit for. It takes a lot of courage to be honest about things that you've struggled with. You know, you talked about your history with, you know, some eating disorders and struggles with body image. And just like wondering, what do you think helped you the most with your recovery and developing self-love? And I'm assuming journaling's in there, but I just was curious, you know, what you found to be the most beneficial for you.
I think the things that were most beneficial were changing the context of the cultural norms of where I was. So when I was part of a very competitive ballet studio that didn't really recognize that, quite honestly, I was starving myself, wanted to sort of look the other way, I think. That reinforced all these negative ideas that I had about my own body and how I should eat. Mm-hmm. And then when I became shifted instead into gymnastics with a coach who knew, hey, this is a hobby, this is for fun, let's just be healthy and strong, much more lighthearted approach to life in general, less perfectionism, I opened myself up to other relationships which were more positive and kind and healing. And so I think it really makes a huge impact who you spend your time with and what the cultural norms are around you in terms of how you define what wellness means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like once you were able to have a better group of people around you, that helped you with your recovery. And I think that's so hard for so many people to get out of environments that are hurting you, you know, and to find supportive people and communities to help you throughout all these challenges. But that's great. Thank you for sharing that. You talked about in the book that people think they're going to be happier if they're skinnier, or like if you lose that 5 pounds or if you lose the 10 pounds, whatever it is. And, you know, we hear that a lot, or I've even thought that, you know, I'll be happy when, or, you know, when this happens, or if this happens. And you really are not going to be happier when you lose that 10 pounds, you know, there's more to it than that. So I was just curious for you to share your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, that's where the idea of unconditional self-love comes in, that our self-love and self-respect should not be conditional on anything, should never be when, it should never be less, it should always be more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in addition to having eating disorder, behavior, anorexia, bulimia patterns before, I have also been obese, mildly obese. And so I have also learned that I wasn't necessarily any happier when I was skinny, or any more unhappy when I was heavier. In truth, what made me happier and what makes most people happier is feeling appreciated, respected, inspired, creative. Mm-hmm. They're making an impact upon the world. And so this framework of unconditional wellness and self-love is about stepping away from the idea that wellness is defined by a weight or a size, and instead learning how to nourish yourself in a way that is about more than any number, and more about how are you behaving. There are five behaviors that are more indicative of wellness than weight. The five behaviors are getting 7 or more hours of sleep per night, mm-hmm. eating 5 servings of fruits and vegetables per day, having minimal or very light alcohol intake, not smoking, and exercising most days of the week, the moderate intensity. So those five behaviors are much more indicative of health than any number, mm-hmm. And that includes body mass index. So in other words, how you treat yourself has a much bigger impact on whether you have disease risk than any scale can tell you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's all really well said. You know, I found too that when people feel like they are doing something meaningful for not only for themselves, but for the world, you know, that can be really inspiring, you know, so being passionate about something and kind of tapping into something bigger than yourself. And I found that to be really inspiring for people as well, you know, just to going back to kind of thinking about your why, you know, why are you doing these things? I think that's all really important. So you're kind of on this topic talking about, let's move to talk about mindfulness a little bit, because I think in order to really know where you're at and be able to make certain changes in your life, you know, it takes a certain level of awareness. And I think mindfulness can be really helpful and beneficial for people in so many ways. And I, you know, you also being a mindfulness teacher, I was just thinking maybe you could share a little bit about your thoughts on mindfulness.
Sure. So I use the Jon Kabat-Zinn definition of mindfulness, that's paying attention to the present moment without judgment and with loving kindness. And I encourage people throughout the book to begin every journaling exercise with mindful breathing. So that means taking about a minute or so to do deep diaphragmatic breathing. And when we do that, especially when we make the exhale twice as long as the inhale, it actually moves the diaphragm, which activates the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is the 10th cranial nerve. It connects the diaphragm to the lungs, to the heart, to the brain. And it activates the parasympathetic nervous system. And that is the rest and digest relaxation response. And so we want to begin our writing journaling activity in that relaxation response state. So I encourage everyone, there's always a prompt to spend about a minute of deep breathing and then to envision yourself unconditionally well in the future. So using that guided imagery of what it, would it look like where you be in your most vibrant state. And not only would how would you look, but how would you feel emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And then once you've gotten into that relaxed, very positive, creative and imaginative state, then you begin to journal. Because some of these journaling activities about mindful self-love, body image, it can bring up hard and painful things in our past. So really want to be able to begin that mindful journaling in the most relaxed state possible. So we have the opportunity to move from reactive, scrambling those letters, turning it into creative. So reactive to creative, which offers new opportunities for health.
That's really well said. I love guided imagery. You know, I have used it myself. I found so many different benefits from it. And I loved that you included that with the journaling process. I think that's great. So, you know, you talk in the book about something really, really hard, losing your mom to pancreatic cancer. And I was kind of wondering what helped you during that time and what tips do you have for people to help build resiliency after dealing with something so heartbreaking? I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Sure. Yes, it was extremely hard when my mom was sick. So that was one of the hardest times of my life. And I think what helped me most was by reaching out to others who I knew could help me, be that friends, family, a doctor who, you know, offered me antidepressants. So really utilizing every modality possible, as well as self-care practices, exercise, journaling. Right. Those things really made a big difference. So I think it was, and it was a testament to the fact that how far I had come by the time my mom passed away. So by the time my mom passed away, which was 5 years ago, I had already really healed from the majority of my suffering from eating issues. And I was quite strong. And so I was very happy to see that I didn't revert to any unhealthy patterns during that super stressful time in my life. So I think that really is a testament to the power of self-love and healing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, another thing that you did in the book, which I loved, is you have a pledge and you have a mantra. I'm all for affirmations. I love all of that. So I loved how you talked about that there may be ugliness in your past, but it's not because, you know, you're too skinny or because you're too fat or, you know, these different reasons. It's because you weren't treating yourself in a loving way. And you also talked about nourishing yourself. I was curious how you came up with it.
I believe when I first wrote it, it was kind of I just let it flow.
You're in your space.
Yeah. And then once I wrote the longer version, which I call the pledge, then I distilled it down to what I call the mantra. And I've distilled it down even further, where the shortest mantra, which may be the most effective for meditation, is just unconditional love. Unconditional love. Mantra means mind tool. So it's just a phrase that you can repeat to center yourself.
That's great. You know, you also talked about not using rules, you know, they're rigid, and using reason instead. And I thought that could be really beneficial for people. So I was just wondering how you kind of came up with that and why, you know, why you feel like using reason is going to be more beneficial than having rules for yourself.
Yes. So the elimination of rules is one of the ways that this is so different from any kind of diet book that tells you do this, don't do that. And instead using reason means asking yourself questions, getting to know what do I need right now? Learning to examine how do I feel physically, emotionally, spiritually, and how is that going to guide the choices I make? Because the moment we have rules, we have rigidity, and rigidity creates weakness. You can snap. Whereas flexibility creates sustainability. One of the rules that one of the principles in the book is also radiant, not clean. You know, there's a lot of talk in the wellness industry about clean eating. And that's something I really like to get away from because the moment that something is clean means something else is dirty. And when something's dirty, that's like saying it's either impure, immoral, and we don't need external definitions of what is good and what is bad to define how we should treat ourselves. Instead, I think we should learn to eat for radiance and in foods as close to their natural state as possible. But by defining the words as clean, then we automatically bring in the concept of dirty. And in women in particular, I think being slim is associated with sexuality, and just like being clean is associated with sexuality. So I like to get away from those terms as much as possible. And really, again, coming back to using radiance and reason as our principles to guide choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, another thing you said in the book that I really liked is that, you know, your glass is neither half empty or half fill or half full, but it's refillable. And I liked the spin you put on that. I'd never heard that before. And I was just wondering, what are your favorite ways to rejuvenate? And in the book, you use the word soothe. So what do you do to kind of rejuvenate and recharge?
So many things. learning how to self-soothe in ways that really honor mind, body, and spirit are crucial for wellness. So that might be getting outside, being in nature, taking the time to have a bath, making time to go see a friend, to go to yoga class, to go see a concert. It could take so many forms. It depends on your energy level and how quiet or active you want to be, but all of these are wonderful. In fact, there's a list of 50 ways in the back of the book that I suggest you can self-soothe in a healthy way that are essentially
wonderful. That's great. You know, you also talked in the book about the difference between physical hunger and emotional hunger. And I think a lot of us tend to eat when maybe we're not really physically hungry, you know, we're sad or we're, you know, you're celebrating or, you know, all the different emotions, and we're taught to eat associated with these different feelings. So I was just curious how you recommend dealing with cravings for people who tend to be emotional eaters or struggle with that.
So one thing about unless is that we're not trying to eliminate cravings. Not seeing any kind of signal coming from your body is bad. But instead, ask yourself, why do I want this right now? So if you are all of a sudden feeling the compulsion to have something sweet, is it really sugary sweetness that you're desiring? Because perhaps your blood sugar's gotten low and your body's trying to tell you, hey, you need fast energy. Or is it that you want something sweet that might actually be mental and emotional instead? In other words, do you need a hug? You need someone to tell you that you did a good job on something you've been working on. And so therefore, learning the why, like you mentioned, I do recommend people have a scale that they learn to use to assess physiologic hunger from 0 to 3. 3 would be ravenous hunger, where you feel shaky, nauseous, hard to concentrate. We should never wait that long before eating, because we're likely to nourish ourselves poorly. But instead, to eat at about a 2, where you're hungry, but you can make wise choices and you don't need instant energy. And to then, of course, honor the body's needs in the healthier way. So sometimes having something sweet is great. Maybe it might be natural sugar like fruit, or maybe high quality chocolate. There's lots of antioxidants there. But thinking about quality and timing and really listening to your body and asking why.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, we're kind of coming to an end here. I want to get a couple more questions in. And one of them, you know, is self-love, I think, is so very important. And you talk about it a lot in the book. But I guess big picture, like, how can we stop making self-love conditional?
I think one of the most effective ways is to think of your body as a set of organs in terms of functionality, in other words. So you don't judge an arm, for example, on the aesthetics of the arm, which, you know, change decade to decade. It used to be that a limp, pale, soft-looking arm was elegant and regal. Now most people want a dense, tight, taut, lean arm. So that's all aesthetic. The important thing is, how does the arm work? Can it carry the load you need to carry? Does it have the full range of motion? So by judging our bodies on their anatomic functionality, we get rid of such a strict definition of what is good, and we move to accepting our bodies as instruments, not ornaments. I think that's a really profound concept. How is my instrument? How can I tune my instrument so it works the best it can, versus my body as an ornament where I'm trying to be good from some defined and external ideal?
Mm-hmm.
So you may not like parts of your body, but you should be loving towards them. And that's what body positivity is learning to love yourself, even when maybe every single part of you is not what you want. And that's okay. Coming to that self-acceptance.
That's great. You know, at this point, I'm just curious if you have any closing words that you'd like to share. And then also if you could let everyone know how they ultimately can find your book once it's published.
I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to share parts of my journey with everyone. I really hope that we can all learn to love ourselves more, to honor our bodies, to find our own whys. And you can find my book on Amazon. And I would be delighted to hear your feedback after you read it. Please reach out to me and share. I'm all ears.
Wonderful. Thank you all for tuning in today. Until next time, this is Crystal Bauer with Live Greatly, encouraging you all to awaken your ultimate potential.